Merkle Media.
Lashback Fridays on Macroaggression. We're going all the way back to the very first batch, March 7th, 2020, episode number 4, Bush Cheney. If you are interested in converting some of your soon-to-be worthless fiat currency, or maybe even your retirement accounts, into physical, tangible gold and silver, you can do so through our website, www.macroaggressions.gold. Tony Arterburn over there at Wise Wolf will help you out. He'll fix you all up. Now, enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tech Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome, everybody, to another podcast adventure. My name is Charlie Robinson. Thanks for checking us out. I know you have a lot of options out there to listen to, and I appreciate the fact that you've decided to sit down and listen to our little show here. If you're interested in connecting with the show, you can find my website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can purchase the book in a digital format there. It also has links to Amazon, to barnesandnoble.com. You can get a hold of me as well via email there, and you can express all your frustrations with my lack of covering the topics that you want me to cover. It's all in there. Check it out. I'm pretty accessible, so if you have questions or comments, just reach out to me through the website. Well, there's, in my opinion, there's no bigger villainous family than the Bush crime family. I think most of us are familiar with George W. Bush. He was president during our lifetime. We saw some of the disgusting things that he did. You dig a little bit deeper, you find his dad, George H.W. Bush, and he flew under the radar with most people because the media helped to brand him with that wimp title as a way to sort of downplay how unbelievably horrific the guy is. And if you ask me to rank people in positions of high power as far as who was the most reprehensible human being in our lifetime, George H.W. Bush, in my opinion, is at the top of the list for reasons that I will get into. But let's start with who his father was, George W. Bush's grandfather. He is an interesting character. I mean, it should come as no surprise to people that follow the Bush family that, you know, from top to bottom, male or female, you've got some sketchy characters with questionable backgrounds. And Prescott Bush is no exception to that rule. I mean, if you were to, you know, take a look back at World War II, at some of the more devious people that were a part of that, Prescott Bush would be a name that wouldn't jump out at you right off the bat. but he's every bit as responsible for the rise of Hitler as some others that have been credited with being at Hitler's side. You don't really hear much about the Bush family's involvement with Hitler. You know, I mean, you might hear that Bush is Hitler, of course, which I think maybe a case could be made for that. But the fact that Prescott Bush actually worked with Adolf Hitler is something that most people really don't know. And when I think once you understand that, then you're like, okay, well, the apple didn't fall too far from the evil tree. So, and Prescott Bush was an ambitious banker back in the 30s. He was the director of Union Banking Corporation, and they were involved in the financing of this new rising star, this new up and coming go-getter that they really thought was going to leave his mark on the world. And that ambitious young Austrian fellow is Adolf Hitler. And it didn't take long. You know, a few years later, Bush represented the German industrialist Fritz Thyssen. You might see Thyssen is involved. They build escalators, of all things, elevators. They were involved in this. It's a German company. So Bush was very much involved with the through an investment firm called Brown Brothers Harriman. And they worked with Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, which is the Fritz Thyssen's company. During the war, this particular company used Jewish, communist, gypsy, you know, whoever, all the slave labor they could get their hands on, because obviously they were a German company. And so to them, this was part of being in the war. Part of the spoils of being in the war is that you get access to all this slave labor. And it was, you know, so the corporations were heavily involved in that. That's obviously no secret, or everyone is kind of aware of that. But what I don't think people realize is that as the war started, financing was difficult. And one of the things that we learn early on is that the banks make money. They love wars. They make money because they loan money to both sides. And it's no difference when it came to Brown Brothers Harriman. They were involved with financing the Ford Motor Company, but they were also involved in financing the Germans for World War II. So, anyway, so Prescott Bush was heavily involved in this, but it really never made it into the papers. And part of that was because he had secret diplomatic status, you know, and so it became clear years, like once the war really got going, that they had a problem. And part of the problem was that the financing for some of these German tech companies was coming directly from United States banking companies. And actually in 1942, Prescott Bush's company's assets were actually seized under the Trading with the Enemies Act. And honestly, he was lucky he wasn't hung for treason based on that. He was deeply involved in this. And of course, that role in international finance would carry over into George H.W. Bush as he came up through the CIA and his ties to BCCI, which is Bank for, well, the nickname is Banks for Crooks and Criminals International. But it was a bank that was started by some Saudis that was heavily involved in using money to finance arms sales and drug trafficking. I mean, basically, you name it. They were the bank for Crooks and Criminals International. But really, you know, the bronze medal for worst scumbag in the Bush family would go to Prescott Bush. You know, even though he was dealing with Adolf Hitler and the German war machine, and he was a corrupt banker who was almost executed for treason, he's still only third place in his family as far as people that are, you know, enemies of humanity. But he certainly did set the stage. I'm sure he taught his son, George H.W., a little bit about what he would, you know, need to know if he was going to take the mantle from him which he clearly did in later years, and become not just the worst person in his family, but maybe the worst person in American history. He really, really has a reputation that is that was buried by the mainstream media. They played him up to be somebody that he was really not. But you know, speaking of buried by the media, one thing that most people don't realize is that when Ronald Reagan was running for president in the 1979, you know, 1980, and then becoming president in 81, he really had no love for George H.W. Bush at all. In fact, he did not want him as a running mate. It was thought that Jack Kemp would be a good fit for Reagan. But the plug was pulled on that idea when rumors began to surface about Kemp's taste for little boys. So that became an issue. Of course, George H.W. Bush had that taste as well. It just was a little bit better hidden. So Reagan just flat out did not trust George Bush. And he was essentially forced on him by the people within the inner circle of Washington. And, you know, he had no choice. It was a deal was to be made. George H.W. Bush would be his running mate, and they would just make the best of it. But a couple of months, if you remember, a couple of months after Reagan took office, he was shot by John Hinckley Jr. And I think we all remember, even if we weren't alive, I was a kid when that happened, but I remember seeing it. I remember thinking that was crazy, that this guy just decided he was gonna shoot the president. Seemed like a random event. You know, here we go, lone gunman again, right? But when you dig into who John Hinckley Jr. was, there were multiple connections between the Bush family and the Hinckley family. It was no secret that John Hinckley Sr. was a major financial contributor to George H.W. Bush's unsuccessful presidential campaign in 1980. And, his brother and John Hinckley Jr.'s brother, Scott, was scheduled to have dinner at Neil Bush's house the night after the failed assassination attempt. In fact, the Associated Press reported on March 31st of 1981, the headline was, "Bush son had dinner plans with Hinckley brother before shooting." Let's unpack that just a little bit and think about how insane this is. The Bush family and the Hinckley family were friends. The John Hinckley Sr. gave money to George H.W. Bush's presidential campaign. George H.W. Bush is the vice president who really, really wants to be president. There's one person standing in his way, the actual president, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan gets shot by John Hinckley Jr., son of a guy who donated money to George H.W. Bush. What happens if Reagan dies? George H.W. Bush becomes president. What a coincidence. But, you know, it doesn't end there with the Bushes being tied to unusual world, life-changing, history-changing world events. George H.W. Bush is the only person that I've ever heard of that can't remember where he was when Kennedy was shot. He was in Texas. That has been established. It's believed that he was involved on some level with the Kennedy assassination. There's pictures of him in Dallas that day. It's sketchy, you know. He claimed that he was not working for the CIA at that time. The records show that he wasn't working for the official records, I should say, show that he wasn't working for the CIA at that time in 63, but he was. He absolutely was. And he denies that. Why would you deny it? Why would you deny that you work for the CIA? Well, because he has a hard time with the truth. I mean, that's understood. So you've got George H.W. Bush unsure of where he was when Kennedy died. You've got him later becoming the vice president in 1981, he was vice president when Reagan is shot by a guy whose dad is friends with George H.W. Bush. And then fast forward to 9/11, and in Washington, D.C., on the morning of September 11th, 2001, George H.W. Bush is having a meeting with the Bin Laden family on behalf of the Carlyle Group at the moment that the attacks happen. I'm willing to accept a fair amount of coincidence in my life. I understand that some things are random. Sometimes you just bump into a friend that you haven't seen in a long time, and this happens, you know? It happens from time to time. But I am unwilling to accept that George H.W. Bush's relationship with all these people just happens to be some sort of wild coincidence that happens over and over and over again. You're literally having a business meeting with the father of Osama bin Laden, who is alleged to have conducted the 9/11 attacks. He did not, by the way. He was a CIA asset with a code name Tim Osman, but that's for a different podcast. But the fact that he would be having a meeting with bin Laden's dad while his own son is the president and they're going to war. I mean, get out of here. That's just the statistics show that that is an impossibility for something like that to just randomly happen in the same way that the Hinckley shooting just happened to unfold with a guy who's, you know, a weirdo who's obsessed with reading Catcher in the Rye 17 times. I mean, look, it goes without saying, but there was no investigation into those Bush-Hinckley connections. Instead, really, all the media chose to focus on was Hinckley's obsession with Jodie Foster and that he was reading Catcher in the Rye, you know, multiple times a day, which is, you know, to be fair, it's weird, kind of interesting. But it's not as interesting as the fact that the Hinckleys and the Bushes knew each other. I mean, how is that not a headline running across the front page of the New York Times? I think, you know, sadly, the answer to that question, that semi-rhetorical question, is that the Bush family will lean on publishers so hard that they'll, first of all, they'll self-censor. But in the event that someone doesn't get the memo about keeping things like this out of the newspaper, the Bush family has zero problem ordering a CIA Pegasus hit team to kill them, make it look like a suicide. You know, happens all the time. So the media's role in distracting the public away from the real story with regard to the John Hinckley shooting, attempted assassination of Reagan, you know, the media's role in that has never been fully explored, I don't think, at least not to a level that I feel comfortable with, because I'm just some dope that wrote a book and has a podcast, and I know that Hinckley's and the Bushes were friends. So, you know, what's the New York Times excuse for not running with this and making this, you know, at the very least, you know, a point to examine with the investigation, whether that investigation be conducted by the police or be conducted in the court of public opinion, whatever. It's worth noting that the Hinckleys are friends with the Bushes. It's a very important point. It's like literally the biggest point, I would say, that the guy who stands to benefit the most from this death also happens to be friends with the shooter. That's important. You know, it just is. So the fact that the media pretended like that didn't matter just goes to show that the media is, of course, corrupt and dirty and involved in this thing. So Bill Hicks, the great Bill Hicks, who died in 94, didn't get a chance to see George W. Bush become president, but oh, I bet he would have had something to say about that, being a Texan and all himself. But he did have a little something to say about old George H.W. Bush. And he said, "People often ask me where I stand politically. It's not that I disagree with Bush's economic policy or his foreign policy. It's that I believe he was a child of Satan sent here to destroy the planet Earth. Little to the left." That's what he said. So, if there was an award for biggest asshole of the 20th century, you would have to give very serious consideration to one of the worst people in the world, and that is George H.W. Bush. Hypothetically speaking, if you had a gun with only two bullets and you were in a room with Hitler, Stalin, and George H.W. Bush, it would be quite understandable if you shot George twice just to make sure. I'm not advocating that. Obviously, he's dead, but I'm just saying. He was heavily involved with the Iran-Contra affair, of course, which was the shipping of guns and to Contras, and it was the using drug proceeds. If we back up just a little bit here, one thing that I think is important for people to understand about George H.W. Bush is that not only was he the head of the CIA, and not only was he vice president under Ronald Reagan and later president from 1988 to 1992, he's probably best known in the dirty government secret operations world as being the largest cocaine trafficker the world has ever known. You think Pablo Escobar was bringing in a lot of coke? It all ran through the CIA, and it ran through Bush while he was in charge of the CIA. If you've ever seen the movie American Made with Tom Cruise, what you see is the pilot Barry Seal, who is flying in cocaine from Colombia, and he is dropping that off in Mena, Arkansas. In Mena, Arkansas, the governor of Arkansas was Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton oversaw that operation to make sure that the state police were involved in that. The CIA ran that operation. They ran that operation through Air America. They ran that operation and used pilots like Barry Seal. And Clinton proved himself, and during the trafficking through Mena, Arkansas, as being the type of guy that you could depend on. Not that you and I could depend on, of course, because we're decent human beings, but I mean the type of guy that the deep state could depend on. He became a made man, so to speak, because of his involvement in the cocaine trafficking that Bush was a part of. So there's this myth that the Bushes and the Clintons are fighting each other, and it's not true, because they worked very closely together. Now, I'm sure George H.W. Bush would have liked to have had a second term, and Bill Clinton took that from him, but if he was going to lose, he'd rather lose to Bill Clinton because Bill was his business partner. And so it wasn't like the enemy beat him. It was like, you know, your buddy at the next cubicle beat you because these guys had a relationship. And in fact, I think a case could be made that when George Bush was no longer president any longer, George H.W. Bush, that is, then he was able to then covertly do the things that he really wanted to do and didn't have to get bogged down with all of that nonsense about trying to run the country. What he's really good at doing was being involved in arms sales, drug trafficking. He was also a notorious pedophile. He was extremely destructive to many people that are on the record, none the least of which is Kathy O'Brien, who has given extensive statements of how George H.W. Bush would torture her with electric cattle prods and beat her. And she called him, you know, one of the most evil person she'd ever dealt with. So there's a lot of, and people can say that's speculation, but you pull up some Kathy O'Brien interviews and you listen to her go into great detail about that and dig into the background of who George H.W. Bush really was. And it's not a stretch. It's not difficult to envision that. And so he later was involved, like I said, he was involved with BCCI, which was an international bank that was used for money laundering, of drug trafficking proceeds, illegal arms sale proceeds. They were involved in the laundering of money for human trafficking and all those things. I mean, if there's a disturbing aspect of the underworld that you could be involved in, George H.W. Bush was involved in it. He was running it, and he was laundering the proceeds through a bank that he had ties to. And when BCCI went belly up because it was investigated to, and it was found to be a, you know, the CIA's dirty bank, then they put it out of business. But don't for a second think that that ended any sort of the money laundering. It just changed hands and went to went through different front groups. So, you know, this is what the Bushes do. This is their family business. They're involved in all the dirty industries that people like to think don't exist, as far as human trafficking and drug running and things like that. But they've got their fingers in all sorts of those things. And of course, he then later went on to have a deep relationship with the Carlyle Group. And the Carlyle Group is a sort of like a hedge fund that takes in investor money, and they, you know, invest in a variety of industries and turn around and take those profits and pay out their investors. And Carlyle Group has, you know, their advisory board shareholders are high ranking people that are, you know, ex State Department, CIA heads and people like that, high ranking government officials, not just in the United States, but in other countries as well. And so they're involved in, you know, they're involved in legal businesses. They're also involved in a lot of sketchy businesses like arms trades and things like that. So, which is, you know, one of the things that he was having a conversation with the Bin Laden family about on the morning of 9/11, which is just, you know, again, just a statistical impossibility that all of this is a random occurrence and that he just happened to be having, you know, meetings with the family of the head terrorist, allegedly, that pulled off 9/11. What a coincidence that is, huh? But George H.W. Bush tends to fly under the radar these days when you discuss incompetence and things like that with regard to the Bush family, because George W. Bush is really the face of the family from this point on. And that's a goofy looking face, if you ask me. It all started when he ran against Al Gore in 2000. And if you remember, he had there was the runoff, and the runoff election, it came down to the state of Florida was the one state that was sort of undecided, and we had to have the votes recounted and all that good stuff. And who was in charge of that recount, and who was the governor of Florida? Oh, it was Jeb Bush. What a coincidence. That's really, I'm sure that that's going to be an objective recount, right? When you've got the brother of the potential president involved in it. And of course, all the sketchy shit that, you know, goes down in Florida, in Broward County, and then, you know, involved in with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and all the DNC stuff, which I understand that Republicans and Democrats are technically different parties. But once you really analyze the way the system works, what you find is that they're all the same people, just pretending one team is wearing red jerseys, the other team's wearing blue jerseys. So it's not that big of a difference. But the reason why Al Gore was not president, was not allowed to become president, and why George W. Bush was because he was necessary to be the president, the absentee president that he was to become, because 9/11 had to happen the way it was going to happen. And with Al Gore in there, he wasn't in on the plan, as far as we know, but the Bushes were. And the plan was step aside because Cheney's running it. He's running the op, and what you need to do is be the president and do what you're told, but stand off, take two steps to the right, because Cheney's going to step forward and run this operation. Because the people that are behind 9/11 were not 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters, but they were the people that wrote the Project for a New American Century, and involved in that was Dick Cheney. And not to say that he was the only one, or not to say that that group was the only one, but they had involvement in it. And for people that say that, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist, if you believe that 9/11 was an inside job, well, I would say to those people, if what you know about 9/11 is what you saw on your nightly news, then you don't know anything about 9/11, because it's much deeper than that. And those people were involved. They planned it. They executed it. And they had the orders for everyone to stand down. And George W. Bush was just sort of the poster child for that. He was a built-in layer of incompetence that when you looked at him, you couldn't find it. You couldn't see a mastermind, you know? You just couldn't. He just wasn't the type of guy that you thought, well, maybe he planned this whole thing. No, he just wasn't really qualified. He wasn't really capable about that. And how do you know that? I mean, why did we think that? We didn't just arbitrarily come up with it. Well, we came up with the idea that George Bush wasn't smart enough to figure that whole thing out, because George Bush is a big dummy. I mean, I'm not trying to be mean about it, but he is not a bright guy. And it's evident by the, you know, when he says that this is here's some quotes from George W. Bush proving that he's a genius. Rarely is the question asked, is our children learning? Well, the reason why that question's not asked like that is because it's grammatically incorrect, you big dope. There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, you can't get fooled again. Remember that one? I mean, so you see these things. You see George W. coming out and saying things like, our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we. I mean, it's just he's like a cartoon character. Of course, he's like Foghorn Leghorn or something. You know, he's just so ridiculous that you kind of have to laugh. The problem is that the things that he's involved with aren't funny, and so you laugh at him because he's such a dipshit. But you can't laugh at the outcome because it's so serious. When you're talking about things like 9/11, Afghanistan invasion, Iraq invasion, you know, things like that, these are literally life and death occurrences. And you've got a guy involved in it who is, you know, unable to figure out how to work a pencil sharpener. So, you know, you've got of course, the next step is, well, if he's not in charge, who is? And I think it didn't take people too long to just take one peek behind and see that Darth Vader was the vice president for those 8 years. And you want to talk about a guy with no soul and a really dark, ominous presence. That is Dick Cheney. Take a break for just a minute so I can tell you about our two sponsors. Scribd offers unlimited ebooks, unlimited audiobooks from major publishers, and unlimited magazines, all for $9.99 a month. It's a great deal. You can actually sign up for 30 days for free, no charge. Cancel whenever you want if you don't like it. It's an amazing resource. It's a lot cheaper than Audible. They offer unlimited amounts of information here. If you're like me, you geek out with this sort of stuff. To be able to have access to all these audiobooks, regular books, and everything. If you're into conspiracies, if you're into JFK, if you're into aliens or Bigfoot, or, you know, the sinking of the Lusitania, it's all in there. They've got all sorts of information on that. So check out Scribd. If you like it and you sign up for it, it benefits the show directly. We do appreciate that. But also, if you're into that sort of stuff, you're probably, like me, way into documentaries. I geek out. I've seen everything there is to see on Netflix, it seems like. And what's great about CuriosityStream is that you have access to literally thousands of documentaries. Award-winning types, exclusives, originals. You can watch them anywhere. You can cancel your service anytime. It comes in high-definition quality. There's unlimited streaming of thousands of shows. You can stream it on your laptop, your TV, your phone, your tablet. You can even view it offline. It's $19.99 a year or $2.99 a month. That is a small price to pay for acquiring additional information. If you're listening to this podcast, then you are interested in non-traditional information. You're seeking it out. Go take a look at CuriosityStream. The link is in the description box below. You sign up with them, it directly benefits the show. We certainly do appreciate that. Thanks for supporting our show, and thank you for supporting our sponsors as well. One of the reasons why the Bush administration did not receive the scrutiny from the media that it deserved about 9/11 was because the media was terrified of Dick Cheney. He was a very intimidating guy. He's a very aggressive guy. He's a reprehensible human being. He's one of the worst people walking the planet these days. He's universally loathed by everyone, even people that worked in there. I mean, nobody really liked him. So you go back to George W. Bush in the days after 9/11, and I don't know, you know, I wasn't in Manhattan on 9/11. I was in Manhattan Beach, California on 9/11, fair opposite side of the country. But I remember that like it was yesterday. And in the days after that, at least the United States was in sort of like a big fog. It was a strange time. Everyone kind of felt a little disjointed, like if you'd had a huge earthquake or something, and you know, you're cable was out and your power was out, and you'd open your door and walk outside and just try to make sense of it all, and you'd see your neighbor. So there were a lot of people that were talking to their neighbors and talking to strangers and just trying to figure it out, just trying to hoping that maybe somebody would come around and explain this, give them some sort of insight as to what happened to make them feel a little bit better. But that, so George W. Bush decides he's going to be the leader. He's going to be the leader that he should be, right? He's going to grab the megaphone. He's going to go up on this big piling heap of smoldering debris. And he said, with his megaphone to the first responders, "I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon." So, wow, that's what a strong leader would say, right? Maybe we've got this guy all wrong. Maybe he was just sandbagging it the whole time, and maybe he's actually a closeted tough guy. He goes on to say, "The most important thing for us to find Osama bin Laden. It is our number one priority, and we will not rest until we find him." I mean, USA, USA. I mean, you could hear people chanting that after all that. Then you just fast forward. That was September of 2001. Fast forward 6 months, March 13th. 2002, George W. Bush. "I don't know where bin Laden is. I have no idea and really don't care. It's not that important. It's not our priority." Well, congratulations. You went from, "We will not rest until we find him. It's our number one priority," to, "It's not that important. It's not our priority," in a grand total of 6 months. So in 6 months, he did that. Asked again about it, "I'm truly not that concerned about Osama bin Laden." You know, so, I mean, the obvious question is, why aren't you concerned about him, right? This is the guy that did this. This is the guy that orchestrated this massive hijacking, right? Your first statement about how "we will not rest until we find him, and he is our number one priority," that should be the guiding principle from that moment until the day you drag Osama bin Laden out and either put him on trial or, shoot him, right? One of those two things. But it should never waver from that. And it especially not in just 6 months. But it gets better. He goes on to say this about bin Laden. "Who knows if he's hiding some cave or not? We haven't heard from him in a long time. The idea of focusing on one person really indicates to me people don't understand the scope of the mission. Terror is bigger than one person. He's just a person who's been marginalized. I don't know where he is. I really just don't spend that much time on him, to be honest with you. Wow. He just got done telling us that he wasn't going to rest until we found him, and now he doesn't spend that much time on him. Perhaps I'm missing something here, because we spent billions of dollars trying to find the guy that knocked over three buildings with two planes, and for this piece of shit to lecture us on not understanding the scope of the mission is unbelievably insulting to our intelligence. And I think it just goes to show that it was never about bin Laden, because bin Laden didn't do it. I'm sorry. If this is news to you, then what is your excuse, man? You've had two decades to figure this out. Osama bin Laden didn't do 9/11. He didn't. He's not on the FBI's terror watch list for he's not on the top 10 list, or he wasn't, you know, when he was alive, allegedly. He was never on their list. They never considered him a suspect. They didn't have enough evidence for it. The evidence against Osama bin Laden came from the Bush administration. You know, the Bush administration that's filled with such legendary scumbags as Donald Rumsfeld, Karl Rove, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice. I mean, I wouldn't trust these people to, you know, give me the weather forecast. They're not to be trusted on any level. They're professional liars. They're career politicians and neocon scumbags. And not to mention the fact that, you know, if you dig into the George W. Bush administration, you've got that administration is packed with dual Israeli citizens, dual U.S. Israeli citizens. So you've got to wonder about the motivation. Was 9/11 about knocking down buildings in New York City, or was it creating the pretense to reshape the Middle East according to, you know, somebody else's vision? And when you read the Project for New American Centuries document that came out in September of 2000, 12 months before the actual attack, it talks about the need for a catalyzing catastrophic event like a new Pearl Harbor to kick off the remaking of the Middle East. So if you're still cheerleading that Obama was able to kill Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, you know, years ago, I think you need to just settle down and maybe take a look at some alternative versions of history, because what really happened in 9/11 is not the same story as what the media sold to the general public for the last two decades, and has never really veered off of that, even though unbelievable amounts of evidence have come forward to contradict the official story. You know, part of the reason for these Gulf Wars that the United States concocted in Afghanistan and Iraq was to secure oil and mineral resources in this region of the world that Zbigniew Brzezinski referred to as Eurasia. America wasn't actually seeking revenge, as we were led to believe. It was seeking oil. And this has been a longstanding plan by those that are in positions of power. And so to better understand the scope of the mission, you would need to read Brzezinski's book, The Global Chessboard. And he lays it out there in remarkably simple terms. He says, it is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus also challenging America. The formulation of a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian geostrategy is, therefore, the purpose of this book that he wrote. And, you know, look, Zbigniew Brzezinski was a legendary psychopath. And, you know, he was intelligent and calculating and completely devoid of anything resembling empathy, compassion, or remorse, or anything. You can't do the things that Brzezinski was doing and advocate for these sorts of things and consider yourself to be just still a normal human being. He just wasn't the case. You know, George Bush would say, you know, Brzezinski was brilliant, He was evil, of course, but he was an evil genius. Kind of looked like one, too. But George W. Bush comes out and says things like this. I just want you to know that when we're talking about war, we're really talking about peace. No, we're not. We're not doing that. We're not talking about peace when we're talking about war. This is bullshit. This is total inversion. This is what these people do. The problem is, see, Kissinger and George H.W. Bush and Brzezinski and these guys can talk about things and make them look backwards. They can invert the truth because they're brilliant. I mean, like I said, evil, but brilliant. George W. Bush is so fucking stupid, he doesn't know how to do that. So he winds up saying things like, I just want you to know that when we're talking about war, we're really talking about peace. And it's such a transparently backward statement that nobody took it seriously. But these guys that are deeply involved in like the Luciferianism and the, you know, all of this inversion, black is white is black, up is down is up. These guys have an art to it. There is a way that they explain it that is backwards, but sounds kind of logical. But W never figured that out. He's just a, you know, he's just, you know, eating paint chips and stuff because he never developed into this. He's this, you know, he's the second or third generation guy that's not as ambitious as his father or his father's father and as Prescott Bush was. He's just sort of like, you know, he's Jeb. He's like Jeb. He's just low energy Jeb. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump and shit. When he calls him low energy Jeb, you know, he was dead on. But not only was W an idiot, I'm talking about him in the past tense, which is funny, because he's kind of irrelevant now. But not only is he an idiot, he's also like a hardcore religious zealot, which is funny. He said this one time, and this is just, I mean, this sounds fake, but he honestly did say this. He said, I am driven with a mission from God. God would tell me, George, go and fight these terrorists in Afghanistan. And I did. And then God would tell me, George, go and end the tyranny in Iraq. And I did. And now, again, I feel God's words coming to me. Go get the Palestinians their state and get the Israelis their security and get peace in the Middle East. And by God, I'm going to do it. Hey, George, it's God. Go run in front of the, go run in the street, you big dummy. I mean, this is, saying things like that will get you put in a mental institution. Or it'll get you a spot on Joel Osteen's show, or one of the two. There might not be a difference between that. But this was our president. God is speaking to him. God is telling him these things to go do. And he's going to do it. That's what Iraq was. Don't worry about if your son died in Afghanistan or Iraq in these war, don't worry, because it's fine. Because God told George W. Bush that he wants him to do this. Okay. So buck up, you know, put a smile on. Yeah. Your son's never coming home from war, but it's okay because the imaginary man in the sky told the fake president that that's what he wants him to do. That's what we're working with here. That's the Bush administration, a bunch of maniac religious zealots defining what they read in a book, pretending that it gave them some sort of holy inspiration and that they were somehow ordained by God to start this crusade. And George Bush used that word crusade. We are on a crusade, not realizing the implications of that word when discussing invading Muslim countries and talking about we're on a crusade. I mean, Jesus Christ, in more ways than one. How do you not know that? How are you not more aware of the words that are coming out of your mouth when you're talking about invading Muslim countries with Christian armies than you're talking about it being a crusade? He literally used the exact words, crusade. So, you know, I think the Iraqis and the Afghanis and all the people that have been affected by this our right to be terrified by a maniac that comes and says that, and they should never think that there's going to be some sort of peace, because the person that's in charge of this invasion is labeling it a crusade, and we know how that ended, right? That didn't go well for the non-believers. So, you know, that's coming your way. But by all means, we're just going after Osama bin Laden until 6 months later, and then we forgot who Osama bin Laden was, and then it became about something else. What it became about, I'm still trying to figure out. Ask the average person on the street, hey man, why are we still in Afghanistan? Just pick someone in your family. Actually, this will be a fun exercise. Go find someone in your family and just say, I have one question for you, just a quick one. Why are we still in Afghanistan? And wait and see what their answer is. I guarantee you their answer will be, I have no idea. Nobody knows. Nobody knows why we're still in Afghanistan. I mean, nobody knows why we're supposed to be in Afghanistan. We know why we're really there. And we know why we're never leaving there, because it's a strategic location. It's the intersection of Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. It is, as Zbigniew Brzezinski quite accurately described it, it is an important region, and they did not want to give up the control of that region to somebody that didn't have American values. I put that in air quotes. So if we weren't going to have somebody with American values in charge of that region, well, then we were going to be in charge of that region. So that's why we're there. That's why we're never leaving. We're never leaving, by the way. You could bring in Osama bin Laden, or we can Freudian slip. We can bring in Obama, and we can bring in Donald Trump, and we can bring in whoever's next as president, and they can all tell you that once I become president, we're out of Afghanistan. It's not happening. It's not ever going to happen, not in our lifetimes, because the military-industrial complex wants us to be there because they make a fortune off of it. The oil companies need the protection. There's too many natural resources there, be they minerals and, you know, all of the resources that come in the ground and also above ground in the poppy fields. And the poppy fields are important because the CIA manages the poppy fields, because poppy turns into opium, and the opium turns into heroin, and heroin and drug trafficking are the blood that keeps the CIA alive. The money that they generate from the sale of drugs worldwide. Forget the Colombian cartels and the Sinaloa cartels. They work for the CIA. The CIA runs the drug trade on this planet. Don't kid yourself for one second. They are in charge of it. The money that Congress allocates towards the CIA's budget every year only goes so far and can only be used for so many things. The CIA, in order to run their black budget, their off-books operations that they don't disclose to Congress, they need the money that comes from the sale of drugs to finance those operations. And that's why the CIA has been busted with private jets with CIA, you know, tail numbers associated to CIA front companies that crash and, you know, on their way back from Colombia that are filled with tons of cocaine. And they're like, wow, that's peculiar that this plane has all this cocaine on it and it's registered to a company run by the CIA. Yeah, that's how it works. That's how the drugs come in. That's why they were able to, you know, work. They're able to work with Noriega, and they're able to work with Pablo Escobar, and they're able to work with El Chapo and all these guys, and then they wind up putting them in jail or they wind up shooting them, because the CIA will double cross you at some point, which is what happens. So if you get nothing out of this episode, understand this. Don't ever go into business with the CIA. They'll fuck you over in the end. They just will. That's what they do. But, you know, we goof on George W. Bush because he's an easy target, and of course he deserves it, obviously. But there is one brilliant decision that W made, and that was to select... But this is brilliant by his standards. I mean, not brilliant for the rest of us, but it was to select Dick Cheney as his vice president, because he was pretty much assured not to get assassinated by anyone except maybe Dick Cheney, as long as Cheney was waiting as his backup. You know, he was on deck to be the president. Nobody wanted that, right? So kind of kept W alive. I remember there was a time when Howard Stern was joking around. He had Jesse Ventura on, and Jesse Ventura said that he was going to run for president. And then he joked, I should have you, Howard, be my vice president. That way I'm assured that nobody will kill me. Nobody will try to assassinate me, because if they did, then you'd be the president. And so to have Dick Cheney as your vice president did a pretty good job of sort of ensuring that you would stay upright for as long as possible. And David Letterman actually had a pretty funny quote. He was talking about Dick Cheney. He said, you know, we've made a lot of jokes about Dick Cheney and hunting and shooting his buddy in the face, but he really is a great sportsman. I mean, before he shoots the pheasant, he makes it dig its own grave. Here's a sample. You know, we know Dick Cheney is a reprehensible scumbag, but he also had a taste for lying just about any time he got a microphone in front of his face. So here's a sample of some of his lies. The issue is that Saddam has chemical weapons. Obviously, we know that's a lie. Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. We do know with absolute certainty that Saddam is using his procurement system to acquire the equipment he needs in order to enrich uranium to build a nuclear weapon. We now have irrefutable evidence that Saddam has once again set up and reconstituted his program to take uranium, to enrich it to sufficiently high grade so that it will function as the base material as a nuclear weapon. And there is no doubt about the fact that the level of effort has escalated in recent months. We know, for example, that prior to our goal going in, that Saddam had spent time and effort acquiring mobile biological weapons labs, and we're quite confident he did, in fact, have such a program. We found a couple of semi-trailers at this point, which we believe were, in fact, part of that program. I would deem that conclusive evidence, if you will, that he did, in fact, have programs for weapons of mass destruction. I mean, he just keeps qualifying these answers over and over again. His statement is, you know, in fact, and it is certain, and blah, blah, blah. He just keeps goes on and on. I think they're in the last throes, if you will, of the insurgency. That was June 20th, 2005. You think they're in the last throes of the insurgency? You're only off by, I don't know, 15 years. I don't think that the war in Iraq damaged our reputation around the world. Well, I guess that depends on what you think our reputation around the world was before Iraq. Might not have been very good. I think things have gotten so bad inside Iraq from the standpoint of the Iraqi people. My belief is we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators. A statement so stupid that it is difficult to even have it come out of my mouth. And lastly, there's overwhelming evidence that there was a connection between Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government. Okay, listen, there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government. The only connection is that statement right there. That's the only, it's like me saying that there's a connection between, you know, Tom Brady and the Los Angeles Rams, right? Well, the only connection is that I just said there's a connection between the two of them. So that's all we've got. But you know, that's Dick Cheney for you. He's caught on. He does an interview with a reporter, and this was kind of funny. It goes back and forth. The reporter says, "You have said in the past that it was pretty well confirmed that Mohammed Atta had been in Prague." And Cheney said, "No, I never said that." And the reporter goes, "Okay." And Cheney said, "I never said that. That's absolutely wrong." Flash forward or flash back a couple of months. Cheney on camera. Saying it's been pretty well confirmed that he did go to Prague, Mohammed Atta, and he did meet with senior Iraqi intelligence services in Czechoslovakia. And so, I mean, it's frankly, this is minor stuff compared to what all the horrible things that this prick has been involved with over his lifetime. If anyone is still unsure if Dick Cheney is a psychopath, watching him lie to some reporter on camera probably isn't going to change their mind about things. But it's not just us normal people that have a problem with what the Bush administration did during these two wars. I mean, even Richard Clark, who is a former national coordinator for security, he was involved in counterterrorism for the United States. He resigned in 2003 after the Bush-Cheney crime syndicate invaded Iraq under false pretenses. But he said it's clear that things that the Bush administration did, in my mind at least, it's clear that some of the things they did were war crimes. So that's Richard Clark, who would know. He worked for these guys. He's just saying, he's coming out saying, listen, they're war crimes. But it's not limited to him. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is the former Secretary of State, and Colin Powell's chief of staff, said waterboarding is a war crime. Unwarranted surveillance, all of which are crimes. I don't care whether the president authorized him to do it or not. They are crimes. Well, it's true. By definition, they're crimes. But, one of the things that a lot of people don't know about Dick Cheney's role in 9/11 was that it's two parts. It was, of course, the lead up to 9/11, where he was coordinating all of the stand down orders to the military and things like that. But then afterwards, he went into major cover up mode as well. In fact, Senator Tom Daschle was talking about 9/11, and he said, it is true that the vice president has requested on several occasions that we not have an investigation into this issue. He was talking about 9/11. So the fact that Dick Cheney doesn't want to be investigated is, whether or not the White House has been given intelligence about an upcoming attack against the United States that they failed to act on. I mean, that's a big deal. Why would you not want to have an investigation into 9/11? Remember who they put in charge of the White House commission report, or omission report, as it is more accurately referred to these days? The first choice to run that was Henry Kissinger, right? And people flipped out about him because he's the epitome of a evil villain, right? He's the last person you'd put in charge of if you wanted to get to the bottom of what actually happened. But of course, he's the first person you would put in charge of it if you were trying to cover it up and make sure that nothing was ever looked into accurately. And I think that when people started to find out that Dick Cheney, while W was reading, My Pet Goat to kids in Florida and trying to project strength, as he said, which is hilariously insulting to say that, but who was really running the show was Dick Cheney from the PEOC, which is the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. It's under the White House. He was running this, and there's a story that Norman Mineta talks about, who was there, and he said that a young kid, he described him as a young kid, meaning like a younger military officer, would stick his head in every couple of minutes and say, there's an incoming plane, it's 30 miles out. And then he would come back in and say, the plane is 20 miles out. And when it got to 10 miles out, he asked Dick Cheney, do the orders still stand? To which Dick Cheney whipped his head around and screamed at the kid, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? So the assumption when you hear that is that the order was to shoot it down. But that isn't what happened. The plane, allegedly, that was inbound to Washington, if the orders still stand, then the orders had to be to stand down, actually. Because according to the official story, that was the plane that hit the Pentagon. Of course, I don't think anybody that has examined this actually thinks that a plane hit the Pentagon. There's no wreckage from a plane there. There's some fake wreckage from planes, but not enough to warrant it actually being a real airplane. So there's some questions to this story. But what is not up for debate is the fact that during the madness and insanity of 9/11, the person that was in charge of this was actually not George W. Bush, but it was Dick Cheney. And what we've come to learn in the years after 9/11 and after his term as vice president for 8 years is that Dick Cheney is one of the most reprehensible people that has ever held office in the United States government. And the fact that that guy is walking around freely with his sixth heart, or maybe it's his fifth. I lost track. It's funny that I think most people would argue that he doesn't have a heart at all, but that's beside the point. It just is, it's interesting to note that while all of us were directing our anger towards George W. Bush for his involvement, he really was put in that role to play the part of incompetent fool while the brains behind the operation, Dick Cheney, was running the show. And I think that when history, well, when people look back on 9/11 and they want to assign blame for who was responsible for that, there will be a lot of blame to go around. But the most important person in that operation on the American side was most definitely Dick Cheney. Website is available, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Check me out on social media, at Moefus, M-O-W-E-F-U-S, on Twitter, Facebook, / The Octopus of Global Control. Check it out.